Would you like more Indefensive Plants each month? Well, you're in luck. Indefensive Plants is now offering bonus mini episodes over at our Patreon page. To find out how you can gain access to this bonus botanical content, head on over to patreon.com/indefensiveplants and consider becoming a patron. And as always, thank you for your continued support of Indefensive Plants. Together, we are helping cure plant blindness around the world, one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How's everyone doing this week? I recently returned from one of the most inspiring conferences I've ever been to. I'm not generally a conference guy, but Southeastern Partners in Plant Conservation inspired me so much because I got to see a ton of different people doing incredible work to conserve plants, specifically in the Southeast, but it is serving as a model for places all over the continent to do better by plant conservation. I just want to give a shout out to everyone that stopped by, said hi, introduced themselves, all the new faces I got to meet, and faces I got to put to people I only know through voices. Thank you so much, and expect to hear a lot of conversations with people that I met at that conference in the coming weeks. But yeah, today is a really interesting conversation. I've recently become obsessed with the Euphorbia family because I was sort of in the dark on how truly diverse it is. I mean, every shape, form, habitat, lifestyle, Euphorbias are doing some incredible things. And joining us to talk about that is Euphorbia specialist Nathan Taylor. Nathan is currently working on a project to kind of outline the Euphorbiaceae of North America, and he's doing it all through iNaturalist, which you can find in the show notes for this episode. But his specific specialty or preference within this group is a small subsection of Euphorbiaceae called the Anisophyllum. And as you're going to hear, you're probably very familiar with plants because these are the prostrate spurges, the spotted spurges, those that you see growing in sand mats or in the cracks of sidewalks in urban areas. They're very familiar plants. A lot of them do extremely well in disturbance and have become pretty abundant wherever humans live. But they're also fascinating from their biologies to their ecologies. And as you're going to hear, we get into it. It was a really cool conversation. I love these sort of specific esoteric topics within botany. It's what keeps me going. So let's do this. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Nathan Taylor. I hope you enjoy. All right, Nathan Taylor, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. How about we start off with a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Hi, Matt. My name's Nathan Taylor, and I've been studying euphorbias for about 7 years now.
Nice.
And I particularly focus on a little group called Section Anisophyllum, which is sort of the sand mat-like plants. So like spotted spurge, prostrate spurge, those weedy plants that you get in your lawn and garden that have that white milky sap.
Yeah, it's cool that, those are something I grew up recognizing. I mean, I didn't know what they were as a child, but it's a familiar group of plants to me. And you know, I think a lot of people that don't live in arid regions, at least, that's probably their main introduction to the spurge family. But I'm curious what brought you to this in the first place. Were you always a plant person? And how did you discover Euphorbiaceae as kind of your focus?
Yeah, so the main way that I found plants is I lived in Dallas at the time, and I was told by my family that we were moving out to a desert, and where, you know, there wasn't really any lush vegetation at all. And in the spring, I just saw all kinds of wildflowers. And being the kind of person that I am, naturally, I wanted to identify every single one that I saw. And it just kind of snowballed from there. Now, how I got interested in Euphorbia is I had a mentor at the time, whose name is Burr Williams, and he knew basically all of the local plants on the southern high plains of Texas. And Euphorbia was really just the one group that he sort of just assigned a genus name to and didn't even try with a species ID. So I sort of took that as a challenge. And from there, when I went to Sol Ross to get my bachelor's and master's, I decided that the best way to study these things would be just to photograph every species in the specimen cabinet and then go back and look at those at home. Well, it turns out that some of the species that I photographed were actually misidentifications.
Oh.
So that added another way to sort of, you know, just push me right into the group.
Dang.
So
That's a really interesting dive into this world. And from a standpoint of sort of species identification and taxonomy, I mean, some of the Spurge family is pretty easy to recognize, although there's probably plenty of minute details, but others can be pretty cryptic, which I'm guessing lends to some of the taxonomic and species ID confusion you just mentioned.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, every time I go to a herbarium, I end up with a really good big stack of misidentified Euphorbia specimens.
So this is a big family, and it's one of those that every time I think I have my finger on the pulse of what's going on, I see a few representatives that completely blow my mind and send me for a loop. But how do you begin to even focus in a family as large as Euphorbiaceae? And I guess from there, we can kind of talk about the subdivisions within that group.
Right. So, I mean, the big thing with Euphorbiaceae, I mean, I'm not a huge expert on Euphorbiaceae as a whole, but it's really sort of divided by the flower structure. You know, some species have petals, some don't. Some are monoecious. Actually, probably most of them are monoecious or dioecious. And then with Euphorbia specifically, you have the cyathium. And the cyathium is sort of this modified inflorescence that looks like a flower. It's sort of like the composite family,
mm-hmm.
in that it has this pseudanthia, this false flower, that's sort of made up of an involucre and then various flowers in the middle of it.
It is pretty wild to think about that in the context of it being an inflorescence. And it's one of those things that when you say or see anyone on the internet say Euphorbia flowers, someone already goes, actually it's a cyathia. But it is a really fascinating structure. And it, I'm guessing, is kind of what makes Euphorbiaceae unique, or one of the characters that kind of unites a lot of them under this taxonomic umbrella.
Definitely. And it is essentially the uniting structure of Euphorbia as a genus.
Very cool. So how did you end up falling into this subgroup Anisophyllum, with, you know, the Camassiaceae type growth form that, you know, we mentioned earlier, is something that I think a lot of people, especially if you live in urban areas or have a sidewalk crack near your house, can probably recognize?
So it fits into a couple of categories for me that I sort of came to appreciate early on. And for whatever reason, I really like weedy species. And I really like plants that are small. And so this just fit in perfectly for me. And the fact that the Trans-Pecos region of Texas, which, you know, isn't that far away from me, is sort of the center of diversity for the group. That's sort of where the plants evolved initially. The region has sort of a representative of all of the major lineages within this section.
Oh, that's really cool. And so they've just sort of radiated outwards from there and made their way up into super temperate areas. And I'm guessing now, because of human activity, can be found over a much wider range than they initially would have in a natural setting.
Right, right. I mean, that said, though, you know, the group is actually diversified on its own worldwide.
Oh.
Yeah, so, I mean, except for the Arctic climates, of course. But yeah, it especially in deserts, the plants love deserts and really sort of explode in biodiversity in the desert regions around the world.
That's excellent. And in thinking about the success of a group like this that can conquer so many different types of habitats, you just said the deserts, I see them in temperate zones, I see them in wet habitats, I see them in prairies. A lot of that comes down to the fact that they've figured out how to utilize a lot of different types of photosynthetic systems, right?
Yes, yes. And actually, it is the only C4 lineage in Euphorbia. And within this section, you actually have both C4 photosynthesis and an intermediate C2 photosynthesis, which not many people know about.
I didn't know about that.
But yeah, so it's a cool sort of intermediary step that uses a 2-carbon molecule to sort of funnel the CO2 to the bundle sheath cells instead of a C4 molecule like malic acid. And Camassiaceae also has a single C3 plant, Euphorbia angusta, So C4 photosynthesis really did sort of diversify first with this Euphorbia section and Isophyllum group. I may have mentioned Camaceae, and basically that's sort of the old genus name for it. So still switching taxonomic gears a little bit, if I say that.
That's okay. It's hard to keep up sometimes, especially with such complexity and morphology and types. And, you know, this is a group people generally pay attention to. So, of course, there's going to be a lot of changes and updates.
But on the subject of photosynthetic diversity, it may be the only genus known that also has CAM. It has all those four photosynthetic systems. So like the succulent species in Africa, those are actually CAM plants. So like the cacti out west. So you have a lot of diversity in this group as far as photosynthetic systems.
That's pretty wild because, you know, they're plants. Photosynthesis is kind of the mainstay of that entire lineage of organisms for the most part. And to think about all of the variety in that system you could possibly have, I mean, just the thought that there could be an intermediate step between the C2 thing that I had never even heard of before until now. And I'm wondering, you know, is there any indication of what the ancestral type was for this group or for Euphorbia in general? Or is it kind of independent evolutionary trajectories depending on where these originated and how they diversified into what kinds of habitats?
Right. So the origin of Euphorbia in general was thought to occur in sort of the South Pacific Islands, sort of around New Caledonia. And it's sort of one of the most ancestral species. It's actually not a Euphorbia. It's can't remember the genus name off the top of my head, but it has a cyathium, but it's not quite as well structured as a regular Euphorbia. And it's sort of a shrubby plant in that area. Now, the origin of section in this film, I know a lot more about. There are a lot of really cool features that sort of unite this group. But one of the main things is that, I mean, it evolved from plants that looked more like, let's say, the gopher spurge.
Mm-hmm.
So like Euphorbia latherus or Euphorbia rigida, that sort of Acula-like structure. The subgenus Acula. Basically, it has this sort of main stem with alternate leaves, but the inflorescence is sort of a plucasium with a whorl of leaves at the base, and then it has dicasial branches that sort of come off of that inflorescence, and all on that dicasium it has opposite leaves. In section Anisophyllum, they only have opposite leaves. They don't have any alternate leaves at all, and that sort of led to the speculation that basically analogous to an inflorescence of that Acula group. Now there have been some studies that have cast that hypothesis into doubt, but the key uniting feature is basically that at the seed leaves, they sort of come out, and then you have this first pair of true leaves. Well, right after that first pair of true leaves, the apical meristem is actually absent. It's completely absent. And so what you end up with is branching from those basal nodes outward. And then after that initial branching, those apical meristems are also absent. So you have this sympodial branching that occurs that it looks dichotomous. It's not exactly dichotomous. It's technically pseudo-dichotomous because it's not an actual splitting of the meristem. It's more of a termination of the meristem. But you have sort of this forking of branches that occurs throughout the plant, and that's sort of the main uniting factor. The other thing that sort of goes along with that is these asymmetric leaves. So you have these leaves that are very oblique at the base.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the sort of longer lobe can extend beyond the edge of the leaf on the other side of the midvein. Along with that, you have, of course, the C4 photosynthesis once that actually evolved. And you also have sort of this dorsiventral structure where there's a clear upper side to the stem and a clear lower side to the stem. Yeah, so there's sort of all these factors contribute to what constitutes a member of Euphorbia section in Isophyllum.
That's fascinating, and it's cool to kind of get into the nuances of growth and development, because that's a lot of where the morphological species concepts are based in, is these minutiae between different groups. And it's a hard thing to kind of convey to people trying to learn field identification, because so much of it seems arbitrary, but it does represent these unique developmental pathways, which suggests a unique evolutionary origin for that group. And it is interesting to think about this group, which is largely these mat-forming species, is that absence of that apical meristem kind of makes them, like you said, branch out laterally, and then you have this dorsal-ventral side distinction between them. That's why you end up seeing these weird mat-forming growth habits, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, it seems like they didn't actually start out as prostrate plants. If you look at the ancestral forms, they're actually pretty erect. But the section seems to have sort of taken advantage of that sort of fault in their development early on to sort of take advantage of the prostrate habit.
Which I'm guessing would have, you know, put them closer to the ground, kept them out of harm's way, maybe sheltered them from desiccation or too much UV light. I mean, there's a lot of adaptation, or at least a lot of benefits to such adaptation, right?
Right, right. And it also allows them to maybe fill in an ecological gap that wasn't there at the time. I mean, when you think of the desert Southwest, there's not a lot of trees. There's not a lot of things that can get in your way from having a more low-to-the-ground habit.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, the limitations of the environment itself dictates how evolution is going to go, but it is really cool to see how these plants have now conquered other habitats. I mean, I see these on my sidewalk cracks, and I am by no means living in a desert right now, but they do really well because they're not standing up. They tend to go unnoticed. They're not getting trampled as much.
Right. Yeah, and they don't suffer from herbivory as much either.
So are they toxic like a lot of the Euphorbiaceae?
Yes. Well, as far as I know, there haven't been a whole lot of studies done on it, as far as I'm aware, but I do know that their sap is very, very irritating. My mentor, Burr Williams, that I mentioned earlier, he actually had to go to the emergency room because he got some of the sap in his eye.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a pretty caustic plant. And it's not only toxic to animals, it's also toxic to other plants, or at least some species are allelopathic. If you wash the leaves and sort of use that wash on seedlings, it actually inhibits seed growth.
Whoa. So it's not even the sap itself. It's not even like the decomposition of previous year's materials. It's actually something the plant is actively producing on the outside of its tissues?
Apparently.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and it's one of those, again, these plants that a lot of people will recognize whether they know what it is or not, and probably a lot of people get annoyed with them because they show up, they make their sidewalks look messy and stuff, but dang, if there's ever a group of plants that deserves some recognition and respect for just being hardy survivors that can dictate their future in the environment more so than people give plants credit for, I mean, here's a group of plants really worth focusing on.
Right.
That's pretty amazing.
I love it.
Yeah, it's within a few minutes, I can already tell why this is such a focus of yours.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's even more to it than that, though. I mean, like, for instance, the seeds are strongly mucilaginous.
Ooh.
And so they can stick to birds' feet pretty easily.
Nice.
And their fruits are explosive dehiscent.
Oh?
Yeah. So even though they're low to the ground, you know, the capsules just explode. So, like, for instance, when I'm out plant collecting, a lot of the times I'll put a plant specimen in the plant press, and if you listen to it, you actually hear popping, especially with the larger species.
Huh, I'm going to have to listen for that this summer. I've got plenty. I let them go. I really enjoy the mat, especially when you don't disturb it or walk on it. It's a really beautiful pattern that forms. And even then, they can take a good beating before they really succumb to any sort of disturbance.
Right.
But it explains pretty well how they get around. Now, is there any evidence that ants are involved in sort of post sort of secondary seed dispersal for them?
Actually, yes. There was a study done in Japan, actually, on Euphorbia maculata, and they actually do disperse the seeds a little bit. And that actually reminds me, on one of your podcasts about Myrmecophony, I think is how you pronounce that?
Myrmecoptery.
Yeah. That actually opened my eyes to a lot of interesting possibilities, because I've actually had a hard time getting these things to grow, believe it or not. They always seem to succumb to fungal infection.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that they're transported by ants, primarily if they, you know, sort of rub off some of that antimicrobial compound.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing to think about, the interactions that are unseen or unmeasured at this point. And it's funny you mention that, because there's so many other what we would call common or weedy plant species that I actually do struggle to get going from seed. And it does seem like there's a very strong difference between seedling establishment and adult establishment and persistence. And it's like that first hurdle, once they get over it, they're essentially unstoppable. But until they get there, there's probably a piece missing that we don't fully understand or recognize.
Yeah. And it is really, really interesting to think about that.
Yeah. And so when you're looking for these plants or collecting, I mean, what are you working on these days? What's kind of been your focus other than just really enjoying this subgroup of Euphorbiaceae?
So I do a lot of iNaturalists. It's really kind of interesting how that sort of opened up my ability to study these plants. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy identifying plants. I enjoy writing papers as well, but since I'm not actually at a university at the moment, you know, mostly I'm just spending my time enjoying the identification of these things. And, you know, most of the key characters are actually on the seeds.
Oh.
Yeah, so it proves a particularly fun challenge to identify these plants from pictures. That's one thing that sort of I was sort of skeptical of iNaturalists at the start, because you really kind of need seeds and cyathia to identify these things. But it turns out that the vast majority of species, even in section and isophyllum, are identifiable from habit and leaves and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually sort of opened my eyes in a number of ways, because I found out that one of the big challenges with section and isophyllum is that the leaves are quite variable, but there's actually a pattern to that variability. They produce like 3 to 4 different sets of leaves, and some of those are more taxonomically informative than others, particularly the second set, sort of the set produced right after the very first leaves are developed. And they tend to be more asymmetric than the rest of the leaves, and they have a more consistent shape to them, and consistently different from other species. So that's one thing that I've sort of found using iNaturalists. I mean, the other thing is I've also been able to see even some undescribed species using iNaturalists. Yeah, and that's proven to be particularly fun.
Now, is this a situation where someone just takes a picture and posts it and you find it and go like, hey, that's something we don't know yet, and they were unaware of it? Or are you just kind of commuting back and forth with a lot of other people who are on some level equally obsessed with this group?
Well, so it's mostly the former.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are some other Euphorbia experts that have gotten on iNaturalists as well, but they don't add as many observations. Mostly this is just from casual citizen sciences, just, you know, going into the backyard or going to a national park and photographing a plant, you know, identifying it as Euphorbia, and I just come along and, you know, curate the group and say, hey, this is interesting.
That's really neat. And it just goes to show you that technology can be a tool. A lot of times people will bemoan the use of it, and the people are always on their phone. But hey, if they're taking pictures of species all over the place and discovering new ones in the process, I mean, there's definitely benefits to these tools.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's allowed me to look at Euphorbias all around the world, everywhere from Australia to India to South Africa, Europe.
Right.
It really does expand your horizons to look at things from a global perspective and not as much on a local perspective.
For sure. And going back to your point about recognizing some of these patterns that might change, I mean, think about the effort it would have taken even two decades ago to get all of these species together, get enough herbarium records or specimens together to see that change and sort of the patterns of variation among species. I mean, this is a really good example of how within the click of a few tabs, you can have such a rundown of what these species are looking like all over the globe, multiple individuals, so that you can recognize these patterns that probably don't even end up in useful keys. I mean, this is proof that it's not, there's more than one way to identify a plant, but the biggest thing is just getting familiar with the form and differences of form that you can expect from any one group.
Yeah, yeah. And I can't really speak highly enough of iNaturalist. It really has just sort of expanded things so much. Even on the local perspective, it's, you know, I've gotten to see a lot of plants, particularly from Baja California, that has sort of made me wonder about the evolution of maculation. So in spotted spurge, you know, there's sort of this spot, this sort of oblong spot right in the middle of the leaf. And, you know, I've always sort of wondered what the heck's going on there.
Yeah.
You know? Well, it turns out that in Baja California, there's a species that has the spot in sort of two different forms. And in one form, in some populations, it's sort of spread out. And it's actually like, you know, just sort of random maculations around the leaf. But in others, it's sort of centralized. And then there's another species where the centralized maculation itself is actually made up of little spots, little maculation. So you get this sort of amorphous centralized spot instead of the nice continuous oblong spot that you get in Euphorbia maculata. And the thing about spots is that they're not particularly consistent. So sometimes they'll, in any species that can produce them, they can be absent.
Right.
And so that makes them difficult to use, but the shape is actually taxonomically informative. And, you know, looking at those Baja California plants, it really makes you wonder, okay, well, first of all, is there any utility in the plants producing this? Do the plants get a benefit out of this?
Yeah.
And second, how do these maculations form, you know?
Right. Is there a genetic component? Is it kind of like fingerprints where sort of the early developmental processes and stochastic events set it forward?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, that's one thing that I'd really like to study more in the future if I ever ever get into the region.
Yeah, it sounds like you need to schedule a trip.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, in thinking about the iNaturalist component of this and the fact that so much of your identification just comes from average citizens taking pictures, traveling around, not really necessarily knowing what they're looking at, or even if they are, not sure of the importance of it, what's cool is you kind of have this breakdown on iNaturalist for your Euphorbia Species of the United States Journal, where you actually have tips for photographing and then specifically photographing and harvesting seeds, which, like you said, is one of the more important components of proper species identification in this group.
Yeah, I've put a lot of work into it, partially because I wanted to try and find a way to save time when I'm commenting about why I think it's this species instead of this species. You know, I just sort of put together some of this stuff, and some species, I really do need seeds in order to identify them, and I decided this is easy enough to write up. I'll just write this up and post it to the journal, and then just, you know, create a link to it. So yeah, I've spent a lot of time trying to help people understand the differences, and, you know, hopefully that's paid off. I mean, there, I think, around 60,000 Euphorbia observations on iNaturalist now.
Whoa.
Yeah, I've only curated about 40,000.
Oh, okay.
It's,
no big deal.
Yeah, yeah. but yeah, I encounter a lot of people wondering how you distinguish the species.
Well, the cool thing now is by putting these resources out there, they're readily available for anyone willing to look for them. And you never know, again, what's going to hook someone. And in thinking about getting people excited about plants, even non-professionally, they have these questions. Now they have someone that can kind of curate or point them in the right direction. But they also have all of these great resources if they want to dive deeper. It's not a matter of, huh, that'd be interesting, and then walking away, it's one quick Google search away from having a lot of answers available and potentially making another botany nut in the process.
Right, right. Well, and that's one thing that I really have come to appreciate about Euphorbia is that everyone knows of a species in one form or another. I mean, poinsettia is an excellent example. I mean,
right.
There are very few people who I know of that haven't really encountered that plant.
It would be weird.
Yeah. It serves as an amazing entry point to talking about this group. And not only talking about this group, but also floristic complexity. Because I know when I talk to people, they're sometimes surprised that the red leafy bracts are not petals.
Right.
And then not only that, but it gets more complicated because the cyathia are not flowers either. It's another level beneath that. And it just kind of blows people's minds, you know?
Yeah, that's the perfect way of putting it, because we all have these standardized assumptions, and even if you're not familiar with these groups, you kind of go in carrying that baggage of like, well, flowers have petals and, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, when you start digging into this, anyone that's remotely curious about it has so many different things to glom onto. And the cyathia thing, I mean, for species that aren't large and very easy to see with the naked eye, you grab a hand lens and suddenly you've entered into a really complex world of micro structures and anatomy. It is so cool to see one of these things under magnification.
Right, right. Well, and even looking at the leaves under magnification, the cool thing about the Camassiaceae group, the section Anisophyllum group, is that because they have C4 photosynthesis, they produce this intricate Cron's anatomy.
Okay, what's that?
Yeah, so it's basically the mesophyll is sort of lighter than the bundle sheath cells, because the bundle sheath cells, these are the cells that sort of encircle the vascular bundles.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the concentration of chloroplasts are. That allows for that sort of separation between carbon capture and photosynthesis.
Right, which, sidebar for anyone that's not following this, that's a water storage, or at least a water-saving mechanism, because they don't have to keep their stomata open during the day when it's super hot out.
Right, right. And more than that, it also keeps rubisco, which is the main thing that sort of takes CO2 and starts that process of turning it into sugar. It minimizes contact with oxygen, because when rubisco binds with oxygen, it, you know, becomes functionally inert, or it's at least not really of use to the plant at that point. And so it sort of minimizes that contact with oxygen, so it's more efficient too. But getting back to the Cron's anatomy, basically it's this mosaic of dark green against light green, and it's most easily visible in etiolated plants. Basically, etiolation is when the plant becomes leggy, because mm-hmm. they're not getting enough sun. So if you want to see this in person, you know, all you got to do is look in a really shady spot in your yard and look for spotted spurge or prostrate spurge, and you know, just sort of look at it under the hand lens, and you'll see this really weird maze-like pattern of intricate dark green against light green. And those are the bundle sheets.
Oh, that's really cool. A really minute aspect of anatomy becoming visible in a, you know, with relatively cheap abilities to magnify.
Mm-hmm. There's so much when you look at this plant under the microscope to study, and so many ways that this plant can blow your mind.
Yeah. And in thinking about the flowers on these, or at least the inflorescence and cyathia aspects of this group, you know, these are relatively small in a lot of cases. Who's pollinating these plants? Do they self a lot, or are there insects out there that tend to like to visit these cyathia?
So I'm glad you asked that, because in the Sonoran Desert and some species in the Chihuahuan Desert, it's actually pollinated by the smallest bee in North America.
Whoa.
Yeah, I think it's Paradida minima. You know, not all species are pollinated. Some are definitely selfing. I think like most of the weedy plants, like spotted spurge, Euphorbia maculata, and prostrate spurge, Euphorbia prostrata, those are selfing.
Mm.
I think they can outcross, but some species, especially in the Chihuahuan and Sonoran Desert, you know, do have to cross pollinate. There's actually a rare species in Boquillas Canyon called Euphorbia golondrina, and it frequently produces fruits that don't look like they've been pollinated, so it's got to be an outcrossing plant.
Hmm.
Now, what pollinates that. I'm not sure. It's really hard to study the pollinators on these things for, you know, what I assume are fairly obvious reasons. they're just so tiny.
Yeah.
But I have also seen some little flies and some little wasps on them occasionally, and so the glands that are produced on the edges of the involucre, those things produce a little bit of nectar sometimes, and so that's pretty much what the insects are going for. I've also wondered if they're ant pollinated, some species. The problem with that is I've read a lot about the pollen actually not being able to germinate once it comes in contact with the compound that sort of prevents fungal development.
Right.
That sort of antifungal compound on ants. So it's not clear if that's actually going on, if it's actually pollinating, or if it's just visiting the cyathia and actually causing a detriment to the plant. That's another thing that... you know, is possible.
Yeah, it's not unheard of, but again, it's relatively rare because of the aforementioned pollen issues. But again, going back to this idea of iNaturalist and citizen science and observations, I mean, a lot of these plants are probably growing in and around people's homes or neighborhoods, and a little attention to detail and a decent lens on maybe a camera phone or a macro camera can reveal new insights into who's actually visiting. I mean, it might not tell us exactly what pollination is happening, but it at least gives you an idea of the suite, or could give you an idea of the suite of insects and other arthropods that could be paying visits to these tiny, sort of out of sight, out of mind flowers.
Yeah, exactly. And I even have a project up for those kinds of observations too, that, you know, you can sort of collect them all together. I think it's organisms associated with euphorbia, you know, nothing too creative.
To the point though.
Yes, yes. So yeah, I'm fascinated by that aspect as well. And, you know, it's also just kind of cool to be able to say that my organisms of interest are pollinated by the smallest bee in North America. You know, that always gets me a little excited.
Yeah, that's a really honorable distinction, I think, for a plant.
yeah.
That's exciting. And so what are you excited for moving forward? I mean, like, what are you aiming for? I mean, you're curating all of these great observations. You're helping people understand this group a lot better and hopefully getting more people interested in plants in the process. I mean, what's kind of the future holding for you in terms of the directions you'd like to go with it?
So ultimately, I'd like to try and monograph Section Anisophyllum.
Nice.
That's a pretty long-term project. They're like... over, what is it, 350 species.
Whew.
And they occur all around the world, and so it's definitely not a small task, and certainly not anything that I'm going to be able to work towards until I get a little bit closer to a good herbarium. So sort of with that in mind, the next step is really just getting into a university to start my doctoral work so that I can be in close contact with a herbarium and actually, you know, study these things on a day to day.
Right.
You know, in the meantime, I've got all kinds of ideas of projects to work on. I mean, just going through what all we've talked about. I mean, looking at a pollination study is, you know, certainly not out of the question. Looking at maculation development, that's not really out of the question. I mean, and I even have those undescribed species that I've gotta actually get to describing.
Yeah. Plenty of opportunities there for you. And again, a lot of this is all fueled by citizen science on iNaturalist and observations of just people with camera phones.
Yep. Can't stress highly enough how useful it is for people to do that, especially in those places that are more out of the way. Like, you know, I get some observations from Peru occasionally.
Whoa.
and Brazil, Argentina, and those places, you know, those are pretty far out of my way.
yeah. I mean, a global call to action to help someone that, you know, if you're like me, you don't have the resources to travel or do it very often. So that's where the sort of communal power of observation comes in handy.
Yeah, definitely.
Very cool. And so if people want to contribute or look up more about your project and just understand what's going on with euphorbia on iNaturalist, how do you recommend they find out more about what you've been up to?
Well, so they can visit my Euphorbia Species of the United States project. That's probably the best place to at least see what I've been up to. Now, if they want to contact me specifically, iNaturalist is really the best way to do that. I'm probably even more active on iNaturalist than I am even on email. So that's a really good way to contact me. If you want an excuse, then just post a picture of a Euphorbia section in this film, and you know, 9 times out of 10, I'll see it and identify it. there's another way to get in touch with me.
The old bait him in.
Yep.
Nice. Well, you're a man who knows what he likes, and I appreciate that. Well, this has been awesome, Nathan. Thank you so much for talking to us. You've definitely opened my eyes to a group of plants that I think I've probably taken for granted up to this point, but I'm going to have a newfound respect for moving forward from here.
Well, that was the goal, so I'm happy.
Excellent. Well, thanks for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Matt. I'm a big fan of Independence of Plants, and keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Yep, have a good one.
You too.
All right, that wraps up another fascinating episode. I thank Nathan for taking time out of his schedule to talk with us, and his passion for these plants is just so intoxicating. I could have talked to that guy for hours. Really fun, and I highly recommend you check out the show notes, especially if you use iNaturalist. You can help him out in his goal to kind of catalog and understand Euphorbiaceae here in North America. But to be honest, he seems pretty active on that thing, and he can probably help you no matter where you're at across the globe. Before I let you go, I want to give a big shout out to our latest producer, Jocelyn. They went over to patreon.com/indefenseofplants and became a patron at the producer credit level. So they get all of the benefits, including access to those bonus episodes you keep hearing about. So go check that out. If you want to become a patron, it really helps keep the show up and running. And if you can't afford to become a patron, which I completely empathize with and understand, at the very least, consider subscribing to and reviewing this podcast on whatever pod portal you use to download it. It helps In Defense of Plants reach a wider audience. But yeah, as always, so many good things on the horizon. Stay tuned for that. And otherwise, have yourselves a fun and safe week. This is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios, everyone.